This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us here as we discuss the important events of the week. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadirwe.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
It's good to be with you here.
We'll start with this weather disaster in the United States, Hurricane Michael. Just last month, the eastern U.S. was hammered by Hurricane Florence, and now the Florida Panhandle, hit by one of the most intense hurricanes in U.S. history. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Hurricane Michael made landfall in Mexico Beach, Florida on Wednesday with sustained winds of 155 miles an hour. That's just 2 miles shy of a Category 5 hurricane and one of the most intense hurricanes to ever hit the mainland United States. I think right now they're still doing some calculations, but they're looking at it's going to be the third or fourth most intense hurricane to hit the lower 48 states. Estimates range that it could be up to $30 billion in damages and lost productivity. The death toll is already at 11 and is expected to go up as you keep going through the wreckage, because there have been entire housing developments just flattened through the panhandle.
Absolutely horrific.
Seen a few pictures, and like you said, that this is something coming right after Hurricane Florence, and then of course, like last year, you had Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Harvey. So I mean, this has just been a really intense 2 years for very powerful hurricanes. Actually, for most of the 21st century, the number of hurricanes has been slowly trending downward, but that trend has reversed dramatically just within the past 18 months. And a lot of people are asking why. As you may expect, and when he took to the Senate floor on Thursday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that humans could reduce the frequency of hurricanes and storms like this if they did more to counter climate change. There's actually one meteorologist, Eric Holthus, who was more specific, saying that was Donald Trump specifically who is actively making this problem worse with his response to climate change. I guess likely referring to the taking the United States out of the Paris Accords, even though those accords were a voluntary, non-binding pledge that wasn't really expected to do much. And then even just a couple days ago, same meteorologist Eric Holthus being more specific yet, where he's citing an international climate change report that just came out this month as proof that the world needs to systematically dismantle capitalism is the only way to stop things like right. Hurricane Michael from happening.
Right.
So a lot of opinions out there that I'm hoping that those are the more extreme opinions, and the fact that hurricanes are caused by Donald Trump and capitalism, apparently.
Well, there was a Stephen Fleury was talking about it on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and mentioned I forget the source, but essentially they said that to call hurricanes like this natural disasters was a misnomer, because there's no doubt that this is being caused by man-made climate change. You were talking earlier about just how if you look at computer models, a global warming type of a situation would mean a different outcome than what we're seeing.
Right. It is actually, as anyone who's tried to plan a Sunday picnic or something that would know, is that meteorology is kind of a hard art to get right. The weather is hard to predict. And there's, you'll see a bunch of headlines this week about how climate change is causing these big hurricanes, but they've actually had a number of models, one coming out just last year saying that warmer oceans should cause fewer but more intense hurricanes. And then when you dig into the data, they're actually saying, well, these warmer oceans compared to the 1980s should be causing 6 fewer hurricanes a year, but they should be 3 miles per hour faster in the wind speed. So that's like barely faster and fewer of them, which is not what you're seeing. You're seeing more of them, and you're seeing them being much more intense.
Right.
And I guess you can definitely say that that is a climate change, and that they have changed to be more intense and more frequent than they were a decade ago. But the models as to why warmer oceans would cause that, or even if oceans are in fact warmer, have quite a bit of ambiguity to them.
Well, yeah, the referring to everything that happens along these lines as climate change, and then attributing that to carbon emissions or capitalism or a president, it really does give them, it's an impossible thing to disprove. They can throw that at anything that happens. But the point that Stephen Fleury has been making all week on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show points back to our booklet, Why Natural Disasters. And that is that if you accept the biblical view, if you accept the Bible as the revealed word of God, there is an entirely different explanation for man-made climate change.
Right. I actually brought with me a short passage from the book of Job that was, I think, very apropos for the situation. I guess for those familiar with that book, Job kind of had a self-righteous know-it-all attitude, somewhat similar to a lot of the people who work on the International Panel for Climate Change.
Except that he was a lot more righteous, I'm sure.
Right. But they took this section where it says, from its chamber comes the whirlwind, the cold scatters from the wind. By the breath of God, ice is given, and broad waters are frozen fast. He loads the thick clouds with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn around at his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, I guess for those who believe the Bible, this is pretty a pretty direct statement that's like, says God sends the whirlwind, he sends the frost, he sends the rain, he directs it wherever he wants it to go, and it's for his purpose. And one of those purposes is for correction.
Mm-hmm.
When you're seeing, like we mentioned before, that they're talking about how these things aren't natural. And I mean, and that is, I guess, similar in our book, Why Natural Disasters, Natural is in quotes. And the fact that it shouldn't be natural, this is something that God directs for a specific purpose. And in the case of when a nation's turned away from his laws, actually there's a passage in Leviticus 26, that's the blessings and cursings chapter of the Bible, that's very specific, that anytime you have rain not in due season, you get too much rain from a hurricane or too little rain from a drought, that is something that God has sent for a curse. It's not natural. Whenever that happens, something's gone wrong with human behavior someplace, and it's our responsibility to do some self-examination and figure how did we let down our end of the bargain, because God's not sending that blessing anymore.
Right. And in a sense, you're looking at the explanation of man-made climate change being a source of two different constellations of sin. You have, on one hand, God telling you you need to stop committing adultery, you need to stop fornicating, you need to love one another. You need, like, his law of love gets very specific. You need to keep the Sabbath. You need to stop stealing, stop lying and deceiving each other. Whereas the climate change advocates in the world say you need to stop committing the sins of electing presidents that we don't like, pulling out of climate change accords, capitalism, emitting carbon. It's a different set of sins, but essentially they're proclaiming the same thing, that we're causing it because of the sins that we're committing. Well, if you do want more information about that, then go to thetrumpet.com and download that booklet, Why Natural Disasters. It goes into a lot of detail on this subject. Andrew quoted one verse, but there are a panoply of verses that explain that. It's a very in-depth subject in Scripture, and it is very worth studying. We appreciate that very much, Andrew. For our next couple of stories, we're going to look at the tension rising between Russia and Europe. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has written extensively about Bible prophecies showing how Russia's provocations will frighten and catalyze Europe. And that's exactly what we're seeing happening. For this, we'll go to Anthony Chibatowe.
Let me start with a quote from The Guardian. It says this: "It is now possible that Western Europeans will feel a new closeness to the Poles and the Balts, who have long warned about Russia's encroachments." Again, that's from the Guardian. It's an article from October 9th. And the author writes that Vladimir Putin's plan to divide Europe is actually backfiring. The article makes the case that the increasing provocations from Putin's Russia are helping to, quote, bridge some gaps between European sensitivities and unwittingly acting as a catalyst for European unification. The Guardian writes this. I have a lengthy quote. It begins like this: "As the truth about its spy activities unravels, Russia becomes a bigger problem for all Europeans, not just those in the East. Kremlin-fostered disruption can no longer be mostly depicted as a strategy aimed at keeping former Soviet satellite states under Moscow's sway. Rather, Russia's attempts to undermine institutions are now evident across Europe. Since the fall of communism, Eastern Europeans have often felt that their anti-Russian mindset was caricatured by Western Europeans as hysterical and obsessed with the neo-imperialism lurking in Moscow. After Estonia was hit by a massive Russian cyber attack in 2007, few in Paris or Berlin worried the danger might one day extend further west. Now, with the Netherlands so meticulously exposing Russian actions, it's becoming ever clearer that even small Western European countries with no history of tense geopolitical confrontations with Russia, not just scaremongering Eastern ones, can find themselves targeted." Now, The Guardian also discusses the recent decision of Greece, and this is a country that has historically been pro-Russian. So Greece made a decision to denounce Moscow's, quote, meddling in its domestic affairs over the Macedonian name dispute. The article continues. It mentions recent statements by the French president, Emmanuel Macron, saying that Russia is working to, quote, dismantle the EU, end quote. And The Guardian said that this was a striking statement from the leader of a country that has traditionally tried to keep something of a special relationship with Moscow. And regarding Germany, The Guardian said, quote, "Some analysts in Berlin also detect a tougher tone in Germany's approach to Russia, with a new focus on keeping close to Central Europe rather than trying to engage Moscow." The Guardian adds that as one high-level German official told the author this week, Russia's actions may well give a boost to European unity rather than deepen disagreements.
So before we go on, because I do definitely want to dig into what Gerald Flurry has been saying about this, but our next story is very much tied into this. One specific European nation taking precautions against Russia is Norway. And now Norwegian and Russian relationships are maybe a little bit different than a lot of these Western European nations that you're talking about. This author, this Guardian author who has assembled all of this, all of the evidence of just how much Western European nations are waking up to the disruptions that Russia is making is quite fascinating. It's hard to argue with that. But let's go ahead and turn over to for the next portion of this story to learn what's happening with Norway. We'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think it's an important story. I do think the Guardian author oversimplifies things, perhaps to an unacceptable degree. I mean, from where I am looking at Europe, I see Russia causing a whole lot of division rather than unity. I mean, you look at Italy right now, a major piece of division, and they're really flirting with Russia. You've got Germany and Austria and a lot in Central Europe trying to move closer to Russia, while you've got a lot of Eastern Europe trying to move them against. But I think the common theme here is a fear of Russia.
Yep.
That some people are reacting by drawing close to what they fear so they don't draw Russia's anger. Others are trying to oppose Russia. And so what we see happening
Well, even just to go along with what you're saying, the deal that Germany has made with Russia that Gerald Fleury has been talking about with the Nord Stream pipeline and that relationship, that's another dimension to what you're talking about.
Exactly, it is. And that's why I think it gets much more complicated than, say, The Guardian makes out, with all of Europe starting to fear or starting to come together in opposition to Russia. I think there's a very divided response on how to deal with Russia, which does make sense in terms of what we're expecting. We're expecting a smaller 10-nation Europe. But what I think does really illustrate, though, the overall point is that NATO is holding their largest ever war games since the end of the Cold War. We had those from Russia just a few weeks ago, perhaps even the largest ever war games in history. Europe's launching their largest ever war game since the end of the Cold War, and they're doing that in Norway. And these are very practical war games. So the thinking during the Cold War was, okay, what happens if there's a ground invasion by the Soviet Union of Western Europe? Well, the key thing for the Allies to do is to resupply across the Atlantic, bring in American troops. Russia will want to stop that. How will they stop that? Using aircraft, and they'll need to overfly Norwegian airspace in order to intercept those ships in the Atlantic. Therefore, American NATO Cold War planners believed that if Russia invaded Western Europe, they would accompany that invasion with a smaller attack on Norway, and that the best response to that would be to have a rapid response within Norway and fight Russia there. And they believed that such an attack would come in the middle of winter, while where Russia believes that they have an advantage because they have more experience fighting in cold weather and Arctic conditions. And so what do you see Europe doing right now and NATO doing right now? A rapid response drill in Norway in early winter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very practical preparation for a Russian invasion. It's not just one of these kind of political or for show, though there's certainly a lot of that in there, but something that very practically prepares to respond to forceful action by Russia.
So it is something that we've been expecting to see the hardening of this relationship between European nations. And you, as that Guardian article pointed out, Eastern European nations for quite some time have been expressing a great deal of concern about what Russia is doing, and that's driving them, in many cases, into the arms of Western European nations. To see some voices in Western Europe making some of these same statements, it is interesting. It's not necessarily, as Richard brought out, it's going to be as clean as what that article might suggest, but we would expect that Russian aggression is going to bring more of this kind of militant type response on the part of Europeans. Anthony, maybe you could just take us back to that that article that Gerald Fleury wrote some years ago where he brought that out. I think it was our cover story back in 2004 where he talked about how Russian provocations were going to yield this kind of response within Europe.
Yes, this was 15 years ago. And Russia had just elected Vladimir Putin, and his party had just gotten a lot more power in Russia. And he said that Putin is much closer to becoming a dictator way back in 2004. And now a lot more people are talking about it, are writing about it. But this was way back in 2004 that Mr. Fleury was warning about how Russia's actions will frighten Europe. Actually, that's the title of the article. It's Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. He says this: the Russian election is triggering a fear that will hasten the uniting of the European Union. A more dictatorial Russian government is coming fast, and you need to know where it is leading. That power will be able to challenge Europe where nobody else can, including the United States. The EU is going to become the world's number one superpower. So says Bible prophecy. Mr. Fleury was basing all of that analysis on prophecies in Daniel 11, specifically Daniel 11 verses 44 through 45. Those scriptures, they talk about a powerful force coming from the EU, coming from Europe, led by Germany. And it also talks about how tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble this powerful European force. And the rest of the scripture says, therefore you shall go forth with great fury to destroy and to utterly make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and in the glorious holy mountain. And he shall come to its end, and none shall help him. We have a lot more information about this in our literature. And Mr. Fleury also talks about it in a Key of David program titled The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And it just brings out these prophecies in greater detail, just showing how much Russia's actions will frighten Europe and compel Europe to do something about it. And this reaction described in Daniel 11:44 is somewhat similar to what we are seeing right now.
All right. Well, we'll put links to those articles. We actually have an article by Jeremiah Jacques going up, Putin's strategy to divide Europe is backfiring. But we'll also give you links in the show notes to today's program to that article by Gerald Fleury, Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy, and the Prophesied Prince of Russia booklet. We appreciate that, Anthony and Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Bible prophecy says the alliance between Iran and Syria is likely to dissolve, and we've been watching signs of these two nations moving apart or being pried apart. To see the latest evidence of this, we'll go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So we know that the Syrian civil war is winding down. There's only some rebels in one of the provinces right now, and so everybody's looking forward to what's going to happen over these next months towards Syria's reconstruction, so that the millions of Syrian refugees can go back to the nation, the millions of people internally displaced in the country can go back to their homes, but they need to go to places that are where they can have a functioning society. And so we've got about $400 billion. That's the estimate of what it's going to cost to reconstruct Syria. And the big question is, who's going to foot that bill? And so we had the United States come out today, or this week on Wednesday. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, came out and said that the United States is not going to give any money towards Syrian reconstruction while there is an Iranian presence in the nation. And this is substantial. Obviously, the United States is one of the biggest donors to such causes. The other big player that we expect to be donating to the reconstruction cause is Europe, the European Union. They've said that they would donate to a cause like that, except they also put stipulations on it as well. There needs to be some type of peaceful settlement there. But they've also given indication that they might follow the United States and say the same thing. And so this is really interesting for a number of reasons, mainly because it does show that Syria probably isn't going to be restored to a functioning state while Iran is there. Mm-hmm. That is the decision that the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is going to have to make. Do I accept the United States isn't going to give me any money, and that potentially Europe won't give me any money while Iran's here? Or do I boot Iran or try and find some way to limit Iran's influence inside Syria and then be able to reconstruct my country?
more and more factors putting Assad in exactly that position where he's having to choose between other partners and Iran.
Yeah, and this is a huge one, especially for Europe, because they want, obviously the Europeans want the reconstruction process to take place because they want to stop this threat of refugees coming to their nation,
right,
or their continent, because that is, you know, that is kind of an ongoing threat that they have. And so you have this situation. I think it's really interesting because you have the nations also that are lining up to be the recipients of these $400 billion. That is Syria, of course, but who's Syria going to give that money to? Syria is going to give that money to companies from two countries, Russia and Iran, to rebuild the nation. And so you've got a couple of factors here. Who's going to give money to Syria if Iran's there? Because that would continue to destabilize the nation. They've got to be out. And are you going to give money if Iran is going to get the contracts from and further line the pockets of the Iranian regime? And so in both instances here, both those reasons, it's growing to become the logical choice for Syria's president to not side with Iran here if he wants, you know, any future in his nation.
I mentioned at the beginning, but talk about prophecy.
Well, we have this prophecy that is really important for Syria. It's found in Psalm 83, and it talks about how there is an interim alliance that doesn't include Iran, and it does include Syria, this alliance in Psalm 83. And that includes a number of Middle Eastern nations that aren't aligned currently with Iran. And so we expect Syria to fall out of the Iranian orbit, and the conditions are being set for this to happen. I mean, Iran is overplaying its hand and has done inside Syria. I mean, it sent its forces there to prop up the Syrian leader, but it had no intention of bringing them home once they were inside the nation. It has tens of thousands of Shiite militias right now inside Syria. They're not going home unless Iran tells them to go home, and they won't go home unless Iran is forced out. And so that's what we expect to happen in some fashion. While Iran's there, Syria is going to be destabilized because it's going to be continuing to attack Israel, and Israel will keep on fighting against Iran and Syria. And so it's going to be continue to be a basket case of a country and continue to be a threat to Europe. So you've got to have this, all these factors are coming together here. But the logical thing, it seems, for now for Syria to do and for the president to do is the easy thing. Is to simply say, Iran, you're out of here. And we are waiting for this to happen in terms of Bible prophecy.
Thank you, Brent. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, warnings of a global recession, India and Russia finalizing a massive weapons deal, Iran missile strikes ramping up, and how political division in the United States is the worst it has been since the Civil War. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
How's the global economy doing? In America, there are signs of a strong economy. And then, as happened this week, in a couple of days, the Dow drops nearly 1,400 points. It's quite a roller coaster. Well, this week, a dire warning was issued about the state of the global economy. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, the IMF published its latest Global Financial Stability Report, and that's the International Monetary Fund. We're not talking about the umpteenth Mission Impossible movie here. And in that report, they warned, or Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, warned that large challenges loom for the global economy to prevent a second Great Depression. And the IMF talking about a second Great Depression, that got a lot of people's attention. You know, it's not hard to find economists out there that warn about things like a second Great Depression. It's much harder to find organizations with the stature of the IMF, this kind of pillar of the entire global economy. It's much rarer for them to issue those kind of warnings. So it's quite a big deal for them to be talking in these terms. the title of their report is "A Decade After the Global Financial Crisis, Are We Safer?"
Mm-hmm.
And basically, one of the big things they talked about in there was just the massive runaway debt. And this was really the big, or one of the biggest risks that they focused on. That, okay, we had this 2008 financial crisis, and the way we got out of that, or the way that we at least prevented that from being even worse, was to borrow a ton of money, was to, in the form of things like quantitative easing, to basically print a ton of money. So we did all of this, and yes, that got us out of trouble. Now, though, what do we do? Because we're 10 years on, and we're even further in debt. We haven't paid back any of that money. If another recession hits, how do we stop that spiraling out of control? And it gave some of the figures. For example, if you look at the debt of states, of households, and of non-financial companies back in 2000, or before 2008, that was 210% of the global economy. So 2.1 times the entire economic output of the globe.
Wow.
Now it's at 250%.
Uh-huh.
Even higher. You'd have to take the world's global economic output for 2.5 years to pay off all of those debts. And that's not including financial debt. And this report just pointed to debt at every level of the economy being a problem. It's not like you can just say it's just government. It's, you know, it's government debt. It's household debt. It's business debt. It's pension debt. It's debt in cities. It's debt in states or regions within nations. Just about every level is borrowed to the hilt.
Yes.
And so the question is, well, what do we do when things start to go downhill again?
So if you go back and do an autopsy on what happened in 2008, a lot of the reckless behavior that caused that that problem, and eventually the reckoning came about at that time, that has only increased in the time since then. Essentially, that's what the IMF is telling us.
Exactly. That, yeah. I mean, they have tried to put in specific rules and things like that to stop what's happening again. But, you know, you go back to some of that analysis that you mentioned that we've published. We looked at, well, really, a lot of these economic crises, they're caused by bad economic behavior. People breaking the rules, people lying, people cheating, people stealing. And you can put in specific rules, but if people are still living in that cheat, lie, steal, whatever it takes to get, they'll find ways around those rules. And that's exactly what happened. And that's what some of the things the IMF points to, this rise in so-called shadow banking. Okay, we put in a set of rules on what banks can do and what hedge funds can do. Well, then people shift a lot of their money into much more murky and places where it's much harder to get numbers from and do their bad behavior there. So, yeah, that's the same behavior that caused the crisis is still ongoing.
Well, as you mentioned, there are a lot of economists out there who have been predicting something along the lines of a catastrophic global economic meltdown. It is quite extraordinary to hear this coming from the IMF, but we do take these warnings seriously, not only because of what the underlying economic problems are that we see, but also because there are a whole lot of Bible prophecies that show that this kind of convulsion in the global economy is ahead of us, and it could lead to a lot of dramatic shifts globally.
That's right. I mean, that was one of the key prophecies forecast that Herbert W. Armstrong made, was that an economic crisis would help cause Europe to unite. And you know, right now, you see people, the think tank set up by Jacques Delors, one of Europe's founding fathers, Notre Europe, they basically said the Eurozone will not survive another global recession as it is currently designed.
Hmm.
So economic downturn would force Europe to change. And you see that on display even this same week, where Europe's kind of stuck in this position where Italy and the European Commission are playing chicken, where Italy is saying, we're going to borrow as much as we want to borrow. Europe's telling the Brussels is telling them, no, that's too much money. Italy is saying, well, then you and whose army is going to make us behave?
Huh.
What are you going to do? And it's just
it's going to force the issue politically the economic exactly. problems are going to make political changes.
Right. So you're going to force massive change. And then just even the whole picture of what is happening in Bible prophecy, you can really see how a global recession can accelerate a whole load of that. Geopolitical Futures had a quick piece that they wrote on this report. And they said, as alarmist as this may sound, the report that came out, it's worth keeping in mind that all major geopolitical processes we've been tracking for the past several years have occurred at a time of relative economic stability. Right. So all of the bad things that we've seen, they've been happening when things are pretty good.
That's an excellent economically. Point. Yeah.
And they conclude it won't last forever. When money gets tight, geopolitical fault lines are more likely to rupture. So you can really see how this kind of economic crisis can accelerate just about all of the different prophecies that we make. You know, Europe's involvement in the Middle East when things start to get tight for oil, conflict between Europe and Russia. It's just going to make all of those much, much, much worse. But this specific subject, it was the you can read about at the start of Europe's financial 9/11 was prophesied. It's a part of our He Was Right booklet that goes through and talks about just how Mr. Armstrong forecasts this type of economic crash in the United States and what he said the fallout of that crash would be.
That is quite extraordinary to think about. All of these trends that we're seeing in the time when there's relative economic stability and how those would be exacerbated by economic crisis, that's quite quite something to think about. And you can even think about just the social breakdown that would take place within countries. There are so many prophecies about how that is going to besiege the United States and Britain. You could see governments becoming much more desperate to make strong, bold, imperialistic type pushes in order to secure resources for their people. Just a whole lot of those things that we could see accelerated dramatically once the economy shows itself to be unstable the way that you're describing. We really appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The Bible also prophesies of a massive alliance of Asian nations, Russia, China, and others. And at the Trumpet, we're closely watching this alliance develop. It is dramatic proof of the accuracy of Bible prophecy. One member of this Asian alliance we're watching is India. For the latest news on India's alignment with other Asian giants, we'll go back to Anthony Chabadewe.
India just recently signed a $5 billion weapons deal with the Russians. And this has been a very big deal. It was signed on October the 5th. And right up till the morning of October 5th, we didn't even know exactly how India was going to proceed with this deal because the United States wasn't too excited about it. The Indians have wanted that that weapon system. It's specifically the S-400 defense system from Russia. And the United States wasn't too excited about the likelihood of this deal being signed because India is a close partner to the United States, and the United States has this sanctions program right now that it can place on any nation that makes any major weapons deals with Russia. And that's part of the United States' efforts to pressure Russia into not engaging in so much destabilizing behavior in Ukraine and with its various cyber attacks and other provocative actions. So there was a lot of suspense by the morning of October 5th. And on October 5th, shortly after Russian President Vladimir Putin met with the Indian Prime Minister, the two nations announced that they had entered into several major agreements on everything from infrastructure projects to industry and development, and also that deal of the S-400 missile defense system. And they approved it and finalized it quietly. Again, it's worth $5 billion, and it'll see five units of the systems delivered to India over the next few years. So this is a really big development between these two nations.
So you mentioned American sanctions that would kick in against any country that does weapons deals with the with Russia. The United States specifically warned India against proceeding with this deal with Russia, and India basically said our relationship with Russia is higher priority than it is with the United States. How worrying is that aspect of this, that essentially we're seeing an intensification of this shift in alliances with India from the United States to Russia?
Yes, the sanctions that the United States has on Russia and on anyone who conducts certain businesses with Russia, these are well in place, and they are consequences for any nation that goes against them. But the United States can make exceptions depending on the situation, and President Trump has that power to make exceptions. So he was asked about it, asked about how he would handle India, since India had clearly sided more with Russia. And his response was, well, India will soon find out. The United States really values its partnership with India, and that's probably why Trump responded in that way. So we don't know exactly how hard the United States is going to be on India, but the fact is that India did choose to side with Russia in this case, and that's just showing how much closer these two nations are becoming. And this is significant because Bible prophecy says that there will be this Asian power of 200 million warriors, 200 million soldiers that will come out of Asia. And the Bible talks about this alliance involving Russia and China and quite possibly India. We have an article about this. It's from our September 2014 Trumpet magazine. And Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury explained a prophecy in Ezekiel 38, verse 2, that shows that Russia will be the lead nation of this Asian alliance. Verse 5 talks about the peoples of Cush and Put. And the article goes into more detail into this than we can in this program. But suffice it to say that part of those people that I mentioned in verse 5 are the Indians. And so Bible prophecy does show that there will be this alliance of Asian nations led by Russia. And we are seeing signs that India will certainly be a part of that alliance.
All right. We thank you very much for that. We do have an article that went up on the website yesterday by Jeremiah Jacques. Despite U.S. warning, India finalizes $5 billion weapons deal with Russia. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. He also points to some other articles there, including our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. And we have an article called The Other Asian Powerhouse, India, which puts India's relationships with these other Asian giants in its prophetic context. We do expect to see greater alignment between India and these other nations. And so this is quite compelling evidence that that's exactly what's happening. We appreciate that, Anthony. Missile strikes from Iran, directly from Iran, have been increasing in recent weeks, including several just 2 weeks ago in eastern Syria. Why is Iran doing this? For the answer, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Whenever we talk about Iran's actions in the Middle East involving how they threaten other nations, it's generally through the use of proxies, be it Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, the Houthis in northern Yemen, northwestern Yemen, Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And they do this for a number of reasons. One, they don't, a lot of the time, they don't have access to these countries and they have enemies that they want to attack from them. But they also do it to divert attention from themselves, give them some type of plausible deniability that they, Iran, is behind these actions. I mean, anyone that's logical and does any type of research can prove that the Houthis are fighting for Iran. They get this, basically, you've got the same missiles being used against Israel, against the Saudis, against more of Iran's enemies by these proxies. So it's pretty obvious. And yet it does kind of restrain nations from coming out strong against Iran, the fact that these missiles aren't fired from Iran proper. What we are seeing over the past couple of weeks is possibly a change to that scenario, where Iran is less fearful now to fire missiles off with their own name on them from their own territory into other foreign nations, other nations. The first one a couple of weeks ago we talked about on September 8th, they fired seven Fateh 110 missiles into northern Iraq, and they killed a bunch of people. This is in broad daylight there. And then they also attacked just on October 1st against targets in eastern Syria. So flew over the top of Iraq, these missiles landing in eastern Syria, take out some members of the Islamic State. Now, you could say that, well, they're not really attacking, you know, nations or big targets. It's Islamic State, that's an easy target. And obviously these dissidents in northern Iraq, they didn't like. Nevertheless, it is kind of, this is a change. This is definitely a change where we're seeing Iran feel bold enough to start acting in other nations with its missiles from its home territory.
Yeah, you put this together with that drone that Iran flew right into Israeli airspace, and it seems like this really reflects an overarching trend toward greater pushiness, more provocative policy on Iran's part.
For sure, and that's what the Bible does indicate, as we've talked about in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. We have this prophecy of a king, a leader of the south of this territory here in the Middle East. And we've labeled that, and our editor-in-chief has, as being radical Islam led by Iran, this political Islam that wants to push Islamic clerical rule all over the planet, starting here in the Middle East. And so we expect, and it was just a hallmark of this policy of this king of the south, is push. And it perfectly describes the way Iran acts. It is pushing to the point that it's going to make other people react. It doesn't back down. And right now it has the confidence of letting the world know that, yeah, we are coming. We are going to use our own name on our missiles. We're going to have death to Israel, death to America written on those missiles wherever they fly. That is our goal. That is our mission. And it's becoming obvious, I think, to many, many people in the world. And so if people want to read more about Iran and our longstanding forecast about Iran, they can read the free booklet, King of the South.
Thank you for that, Brent. Political division in America is very bad right now. In fact, evidence shows it is historically bad. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Any of our listeners have probably heard over and over again, if you've watched any amount of news media, about political division and even leading to the levels of political division you saw during the U.S. Civil War. Well, now there's actually a number of studies and analysis that gives quantifiable evidence that that is the case. Probably the most recent, actually, of those is quote-unquote studies is the actual like judicial confirmation records. Judge Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court last Saturday by a vote of 50 to 48. He had 49 Republicans and one Democrat who voted to confirm, and all other 48 Democrats voting against. Mm-hmm. And so that's a two-vote margin for confirmation, which is the narrowest confirmation vote since 1881, when Judge Stanley Matthews was confirmed by just one vote. And again, that 1881, you're right in the middle of the Civil War Reconstruction period, to where you're just several years out from the Civil War. You've got political parties that until very recently were actively trying to kill one another. And you had this confirmation with just one vote, but it actually has not been that bad until just recently. Another one, there's an assistant professor at Michigan State University, Zachary Neal, who examined all the legislation passed by Congress between 1973 and 2016. He also examined like the social networks amongst congressmen and senators, what senators work with each other, what congressmen work with each other, and found out that the amount of division had steadily increased every year since 1973. And then just a year before, there was another study conducted by University of Southern California, a very similar study, except for it went further back in time. It examined all the bills, like the bipartisan bills between 1877 and 2015, and found that the amount of division is higher now than ever in that study. It specifically found that between 1877 and 1960, you're slowly building more and more bipartisan consensus, more and more cooperation. But since the 1970s, just like the other study showed, the division had gotten worse and worse until it actually surpassed the 1877 data that was right in that post-Civil War period.
That's quite extraordinary. Andrew has an article up called U.S. Political Division Worst Since Civil War, and there's a link to a video in there that visually shows the polarization within the political parties in Congress, and shows the just how little overlap there is, how little the two parties in the United States are willing to work with one another. And it is kind of no holds barred. Anything, whatever the opposition party does is wrong, whatever we do is right. You just see this kind of entrenchment that you just haven't seen in the past, and no willingness to work together on anything.
Right. Yeah. Actually, that is a pretty good video, is because it uses blue dots to represent Democratic lawmakers and red dots to represent Republican lawmakers. And then you'll see in the 1970s, you kind of have a blue cluster and a red cluster with like a purple median where the two clusters about each other. And then it just goes actually like through time up till today, where you've got like a blue cluster and a red cluster and quite a bit of white space actually
never
in between
the twain
them.
Shall meet. Yeah.
But yeah, there's an article up on the website now and it goes through towards the end of it, quotes that President Abraham Lincoln had made just shortly before those studies picked up, when in the midst of the Civil War, where he's famously quoting Jesus Christ himself about that any house divided against each other just can't stand. Lincoln saying, he says it's got to become all one thing or all the other, but it can't endure permanently in this state of division. And then even referencing the Ezekiel 5, some prophecies in Ezekiel 5 that our editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury explains in detail in our Ezekiel Watchman booklet, talking about like race wars and civil wars that are prophesied to break out in the United States. And you're connecting the dots as to like, well, how is a great nation like the United States going to suffer something like that? And it is like, well, it's because you have the same amount of division in the nation as they had the last time
we went into a
civil war.
Yeah. Yeah, quite extraordinary. And Brad McDonald, in his trumpet brief yesterday, he talked about this trend toward actually dehumanizing your opponents politically, that you see them as something like a less evolved version of yourself, that we're actually a more highly evolved people than our opponents. And it goes both ways, as he brought out this study that was done showed that the Republicans tend to dehumanize Democrats as much as Democrats do Republicans. Not a portent of things to come when you look at how this has played out historically. We appreciate that very much. Andrew, I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today. You can give us your thoughts on the program if you just email letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterway, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a fun show.
It's good to be with you here.
I'll leave you with the words of Dave Barry, what women want: to be loved, to be listened to be desired, to be respected, to be needed, to be trusted, and sometimes just to be held. What men want: tickets to the World Series. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.
and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.